You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello, folks, and welcome to PyReps. PyReps is a show dedicated to educating, informing, and piquing the interests of the flying public, student pilots, new private pilots, and anyone interested in the world of general and commercial aviation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of PyReps. I'm Private Pilot Phil, and with me is First Officer Brian Johnson. Hello, Brian.
How's it going, Phil?
Good. I guess today we're going to talk about some really exciting things.
That's what I hear.
This is a different kind of episode, because we're going to talk about flying jets today, right?
Yep.
All right. We're going to talk about a day in the office of the CRJ-900. And First Officer Brian Johnson is going to take us through it. I guess the first thing we'll talk about is what we discussed is the dispatch ACARs. You know, a lot of passengers board the airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
They fasten their seatbelts. They look through some of the magazines or whatever the instructions are. They're looking out at the wing, looking at people loading the airplane, but they don't really know what's going on up front.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to take us through that. And I guess we'll start off with the dispatch and the ACARs, if you can explain that to us.
Sure. So in general, a lot of passengers don't really know what's going on behind the scenes when you board an aircraft for a flight. We try to turn around at the company I fly for. We try to turn around an aircraft in about 45 minutes. So from the time an aircraft arrives at the gate and all the passengers deplane, we try to have the next flight out in 45 minutes or less, ideally. And so while the passengers are boarding, you know, if you're a typical passenger, you board up, you buckle up your seatbelt, you sit down, you scroll through social media, you maybe read a magazine, like you said, get something to drink.
Right.
But the pilots up front, we're actually doing a lot. So we have to, in that 45-minute time frame, get all of our paperwork that we need legally. We have to set up the airplane, all the computer systems and all the switches and controls and buttons in the right places. We have to do all of our safety briefings. We have to evaluate the weather, get all of our clearances and more in that short amount of time while you're boarding up. So if you ever board up when you're getting into the aircraft and you look over to your left and you see the pilots and we're heads down, it looks like we're busy. That's because we actually are. Now, dispatch and ACARs are two tools that we use in order to make our operations more efficient.
Okay.
So when we talk about dispatch, if you think about, let's say, trucking companies, for example,
okay.
Truckers, while they're driving, have a dispatch unit that they use to, again, make their operation more efficient. So in the airline world, every airline that you fly typically is going to have a dispatch office. And the dispatcher for your specific flight is responsible for guaranteeing the safety and efficiency of that flight along with the pilots. So the dispatcher would typically do things like planning the flight, the route. If you want to go, let's say, from San Francisco to New York, it would be the dispatcher's job to actually plan that flight. They'd evaluate the current weather, other factors to determine what the best route of flight would be to get from San Francisco to New York.
Okay.
They'd choose an altitude for you. They'd plan out the amount of gas that the airplane needs to make it safely from A to B. They'd actually file that flight plan with the FAA. They'd look over the weight and balance for the airplane and the performance data so that when the pilots get to the airplane, all of that information will be printed onto a bundle of paperwork that we pick up at the gate. So all of that work has been pre-planned for us. Now, it's still our job to look it over just to verify that things are in order and things are safe. So we look over the paperwork and we evaluate the dispatcher's work. And if we agree with it, we sign the paperwork and then the two pilots brief each other on all the important safety aspects of the flight.
Okay.
So if there are things like weather that we have to deviate around or if there's something minor that's inoperative on the aircraft, we look at that. We evaluate the route. If we have concerns about the fuel, maybe we disagree with the dispatcher and we think that in our experience, maybe we want a little more fuel. We can talk about things like that. But that's typically what dispatch is all about. One of our primary methods of communicating with the dispatcher, other than just by calling them on the phone, is through ACARs. So ACARs is the other thing you mentioned. And ACARs is an acronym that stands for Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System. So you can think of ACARs as kind of like a rudimentary text messaging system.
Okay.
So ACARs has been around a little bit longer than cell phones and text messaging. But what ACARS is we have a computer in the aircraft called a flight management computer, FMS or FMC.
Okay.
And it has a screen. You may have seen pictures of it before. It has a screen with different buttons. It looks kind of like a big calculator almost.
Or like a big electronic flight computer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. I love that.
So most of your typical airline jets are going to have one or two of those. And so we can use that to send text messages back and forth to the dispatcher.
Okay.
Through the ACARS unit. The ACARS is that big, it's a component of the flight management computer that we use to communicate back and forth.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Now, if we have a long message and it's more convenient to call, we can just call. You know, so if we have something out of the ordinary that we need to talk to them about, well, rather than typing five paragraphs by hand, we can just pick up the phone and give them a call at their desk and talk to them.
Yeah, it's a little more quicker.
Exactly. It's more convenient.
Especially with a short amount of time you're allowed. You know?
Exactly. But typically, most of the communications that we do with the dispatcher on the flight is through the ACARS system of the flight management computer.
That's absolutely fascinating. Let's go over, on top of this dispatch with the ACARS and everything, you guys are also, just before pushback, you guys are doing a huge amount of checklists for the flight. You want to go through those checklists for us, especially with the CRJ-900? I mean, a lot of people, even private pilots who are flying piston airplanes, are not aware of just how complicated that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the jet world, just like in the rest of the airline world, we are relying on checklists. Now, checklists are not a substitute for a competency. So we're expected as pilots to be competent in the operation of the aircraft and its systems, but just like anyone else, we're human beings. So
Right. We
configure the aircraft from memory based on the given flight characteristics and situation, and then we run over that with a checklist. So typically, checklists for our aircraft cover the essential items that are critical to the safety of flight. So for example, the flap settings before takeoff, the performance data, the weight and balance, things like that. Those are the things that we're double checking after we've already made the configuration changes.
Absolutely.
We're going through the checklist. Typically, one pilot reads the checklist and the other pilot visually confirms that whatever is being checked is actually in the status or the configuration that it's supposed to be.
Okay.
So for example, typically, you mentioned the pushback. After all the bags have been loaded on and all the passengers are seated and the aircraft is fueled up and the tug driver on the ground is ready to push the aircraft back and everything's ready to go, all the doors are closed up and everything, we'll run a pushback checklist. So in my aircraft, that consists of us, usually from memory, setting the fuel pumps, turning on the aircraft transponder, verifying that all the doors are closed outside, the cockpit door itself is closed, and the rotating beacon is on. After we do that from memory, the captain will call for the pushback checklist. And then the first officer, after that's all already been done, will read the checklist. And both pilots will confirm that everything has been set, that the auxiliary fuel pumps are on, that the beacon is on, all the doors are closed, everything else. And then once that's been confirmed via the checklist, then we actually call for the pushback clearance. So that's an example of how a checklist is used.
That's fascinating. So everything's happening pretty quickly.
Yeah, there is a pace. I mean, in aviation, I don't want to say we rush, because you don't want to rush in something like airplanes where if you miss something, it could be catastrophic. But we're always working with a sense of urgency, if you want to call it that, because the airline structure is based on timeliness. So the company is expecting us to get our airplanes in and out on time. And so in order for us to be able to do that, we're always working under a deadline. If we know our flight is due to leave at 10:30, for example, and we get in at 9:45, we're expected to be ready to go at 10:30. So we're cross-checking and making sure that we don't rush so we don't miss anything, but we are at the same time working diligently to get things done on time.
And there's a new kind of, well, it's not really a new term anymore, but it's due to a few accidents in history, they've come up with a term of sterile cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the time of a sterile cockpit where it's all serious business and no chit-chat.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Typically, anytime the aircraft is moving on the ground and during takeoff and landing, and any flight under 10,000 feet, except for cruise flight, is sterile cockpit. So from the time the aircraft pushes back all the way up until the time the aircraft climbs through 10,000 feet, like you said, chit-chat is at a minimum, unless it's safety-related. So on takeoff, we're not chatting, talking about the Super Bowl or the ball game or, you know, what we ate for breakfast that morning. It's all silence unless it's safety related.
Right.
And same thing from the descent down through 10,000 feet all the way until landing and we set the parking brake and turn off the seatbelt sign at the gate. Same thing, that's sterile cockpit.
Fascinating. Well, that's a good way to do it, too.
Mm-hmm.
That way everything comes together and there is no, you know, mishaps or anything like that.
Exactly.
So we covered the checklist. Let's go over, this probably connects to ACARS.
Okay.
Or to your dispatch, because you kind of just, you touched on this. Weather briefings. In particular, what I found interesting is whenever the weather gets bad, you had mentioned it to me, mm-hmm. that one of the most difficult airports to fly into is LaGuardia, because sometimes when the weather's bad, they shut down the nav fixes. You want to mm-hmm. talk to us about that?
Yeah, sure. So LaGuardia is typically one of the more difficult airports to fly into and out of for a variety of reasons. Number one being it's in very congested airspace.
Okay.
So if you know anything about New York, it's a very small geographic area, and you've got a lot of big airports. You've got LaGuardia, you've got JFK, you've got Teterboro Airport, you've got Newark Liberty Airport, all within, you know, a 15 or 20 mile radius of each other.
Wow.
So lots of aircraft flying in and out of a small space.
I'd say.
Mm-hmm. So lots of, if you can imagine New York traffic on the ground, traffic in the air is not much different. It's always congested.
Right.
And on top of that, LaGuardia is one of the smaller airports there. So both of the runways are about 7,000 feet long, which
really?
For a Cessna or a small general aviation airplane is plenty.
But, oh, yeah. You could do a stop and go on those with a Cessna, a single engine Cessna, but in a jet.
Yeah, in a jet, which requires a longer runway for takeoff and landing, it can be a little hairy sometimes. So
yeah,
typically, if you go to New York, go to JFK on any random day, and you'll see 747s and A380s and all these big super jumbo planes in and out of there. But typically, you won't see anything bigger than maybe an A320 or occasionally maybe a 757 operating in or out of LaGuardia, just because it's a smaller airport and it can't handle the larger heavy jets and things like that.
Take us into, now I'm curious, take us into you said a 7,000-foot runway in the CRJ-900. Now you're on final.
Mm-hmm.
How would you get the airplane slowed? And when you touch down, is it pretty much immediate reverse thrust and brakes, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, in a jet, jets operate a little bit differently than general aviation airplanes. Every landing in a jet, regardless of how long the runway is,
mm-hmm.
is considered a short field landing. So any student pilots out there, if you think about the different techniques you use for landings, normal landings, short field landings, soft field landings, things you'd practice with your instructor, every landing in a jet is a short field landing. Because
so that's an added safety feature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Jets have a lot more kinetic energy on landing. You know, we're touching down usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 130 to 140 knots.
Okay.
In the CRJ-900, depending on our weight and other factors, like the weather and the winds and things like that. But
and converted, that's right around 150 miles per hour.
Somewhere around that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually we're on final. Again, depending on the weight and configuration, we're usually doing anywhere from about 130 to 145 knots, which, like you said, is around 150 miles an hour, we'll say. And by the time we reduce the thrust levers to idle in the flare, we'll be touching down a little bit slower than that, but it's still probably going to be at least 120 knots usually.
Okay.
When we touch down. So we have to go from 120 knots down to zero, or a safe turnoff speed to turn off to the taxiway, in 7,000 feet, which is a little over a mile length.
Okay.
And in order to be able to do that, you have to land with precision. You can't afford to float. You can't afford to, you know, have too many errors. That's why I say every landing in a jet is treated like a short field landing.
Okay.
And other factors like crosswinds or high winds in general, the potential for wind shear, especially going into LaGuardia in New York, because it's so busy, typically the air traffic controllers like to space the aircraft as closely together as possible. And a lot of times, to expedite the traffic flow, they like to keep you as fast as possible for as long as possible.
Okay.
So not all of our listeners may be instrument rated pilots. So I'll try to keep the instrument jargon
to a minimum.
But typically, on an instrument approach, which is what we'd be flying, you'd have a final approach fix. So if you, if you're in line with the runway for landing, this final approach fix is a, an arbitrary point in space where you'd start your final descent for landing. And that's where you want to be fully configured, have your flaps and gear down in their final configurations. You want to be on your target approach speed for landing, whatever that is. That's where you're going to start your final descent. And so usually, not always, but many times, air traffic control will tell us to maintain a certain speed up until that final approach fix, when you'll have to start slowing down to your final landing
speed.
Yeah,
I think I've heard ATC say that maintain 180 knots till NESB, something like that.
Yeah, things like that. Okay. Yeah, so they want to keep you fast up until the last minute. Now, the challenge for us pilots is none of us are going to be landing at 180 knots unless you've got some type of emergency problem, you know, maybe
right.
a flap failure or something like that. So let's say on a typical day, they want us to maintain 180 knots to the final approach fix, for example, and our VREF speed, our final speed for landing is going to be, let's say, 140 knots, for example.
How far usually in general is that final approach fix from the runway? Does it vary?
Yeah, it varies. You know, there are rules for approach construction. You can look in the Terminal Procedures publication.
Okay.
Call it TERPS for short. I forget offhand, and I want to say it's around 5 miles on average. I don't know the minimum rules offhand, but it's typically 5 miles-ish.
Okay, so you have about 5 miles to work with.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Yeah, yep, so a little bit of time. But remember, in a jet that's moving, if you're approaching at 140 knots, you know, you're moving a little over 2 miles a minute. So,
yeah.
So you're 5 miles, yeah, you've got maybe 2.5 minutes or so before, from the time you hit that final approach fix to get to your touching down.
Okay.
And so if in that scenario, like you said, if they say maintain 180 knots until the final approach fix, but you get to the final approach fix and now you're going to start your final descent for landing. So you need to start configuring and slowing to your final approach speed right away. So
okay.
Let's say arbitrarily on an average day, your VREF speed, which is your final approach speed, is 140 knots.
Okay.
Now you've got to slow 40 knots in that short amount of time and get configured. So we've got to slow from 180 down to 140. We're going to be dropping gear and flaps potentially in that time period. We're making a lot of changes in the aircraft that if you're in the back, you might notice all of a sudden you see the flaps going down. You might hear and feel a bit clunk in the back, and that's usually the gear going down. So up front, we're making a lot of configuration changes to the aircraft in a short amount of time to get down. So that's going to happen on every approach regardless, but in congested airspace like LaGuardia, for example, you have to do all that in a typically a lot shorter time.
In a short time, yeah. You're sort of rushed a little bit.
Yeah.
There's
time pressures because air traffic control is trying to get in as many aircraft as they can in a short amount of time to maximize the use of the airspace.
What I found fascinating is you once told me that, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're fine.
That on downwind a couple of times, even into DTW, they bring you in high.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and usually I think what I was told by some air traffic controllers at one time is they bring the arrivals in over top of the departures.
That's correct.
Okay, so, but sometimes you've mentioned that you're on downwind at a pretty high altitude and then they want you to drop in.
Yeah.
Explain a little story about that. Yeah. I always find that interesting.
Yeah, so we jokingly call it the slam dunk.
Okay.
So typically, and every airport varies, but in Detroit now, about 6 or 8 months ago, actually revamped all of their arrival and departure procedures. So again, for non-instrument related rated pilots and just the general public listening, we have these instrument procedures that we call standard instrument departures, or SIDs for short.
Okay.
And standard terminal arrival routes, or STARs for short. And these are organized routes and altitudes that we fly in order, again, to maximize efficiency. So if in our clearance we're cleared to fly a SID, a standard instrument departure, that SID is going to have a route to fly, potentially with mandatory speeds at given points in space and also mandatory altitudes as well.
Okay.
So it maximizes traffic flow, for example, and it also minimizes radio communications, because air traffic control, when they're clearing me, they don't have to say, hey, I want you to fly from A to B to C to D to E. They can just say, fly the Pavel 1 departure, for example. And I can look.
It's in the system.
It's in the system. So I know what the Pavel 1 entails. So when I'm programming the flight management system, I can input the Pavel 1 and it has all of the points in space with any speeds that I have to maintain and altitudes in there as well.
Wow.
And so all of the, most of the departures, if not all the departures at Detroit now, have these, they call them top altitudes. So in those departures, when you're cleared via a SID, it has a top altitude. In Detroit, for example, they're all around 7,000 feet. So
okay.
Typically you're going to take off, you're going to climb up to about 7,000 feet until you're out of the immediate vicinity of Detroit. And that 7,000 feet is strategic because all the arrivals that are coming in on certain star procedures, they're bringing you in and flying you over the airport at some altitude above 7,000 feet.
Roger that.
So that way you don't have a traffic conflict. So the aircraft coming out are taking off, staying at or below 7,000 feet until they're out of the immediate vicinity where they can climb higher. The aircraft coming in are descending and staying above 7,000 feet until they're out of the collision path of the departures, and then they want to slam dunk you down and have you descend as quickly as possible so you can come in and land.
So that would be, you know, just even flying a, for me flying a Cessna, coming in and having to cut that power, like doing a short approach,
yeah.
That could be difficult because yeah. The airplane, as you say, has kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm. It takes some skill to know how to manage the energy state of the aircraft and use the tools at your disposal to get the airplane down and
okay.
lose the altitude in the shortest amount of time.
Take us through that. Just if you're coming in high and you need to descend quick, give us the configurations and the maneuvers of the airplane, just out of curiosity. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, sure. So we have some tools that general aviation airplanes don't, and general aviation have some tools that we don't. So, for example, in a Cessna 172, if you need to make a short approach, you might decide to extend full flaps and do like a forward slip, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And student pilots would know what a forward slip is, where
yeah.
you increase the drag in order to lose altitude. Well, in jet aircraft, you can't do forward slips for a variety of aerodynamic reasons. So that's one tool that you'd have to lose altitude that we don't. Another problem with jets is that jets are typically more aerodynamic than general aviation airplanes. So they're built to be streamlined and have
yeah.
less wires and struts and stuff sticking out because all of those things increase parasite drag.
Yes.
And so and reduce efficiency. So they're built to be streamlined and sleek. But the problem is that when you're looking to slow down and drag helps you do that, you don't have as much. So you can pull
okay.
the throttle back in a Cessna 152 and it slows down on a dime. Well,
yeah,
in a
it's
jet,
gonna start to descend too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in your typical jet, it's harder to do that because it's just more streamlined and it doesn't create as much drag.
Okay.
So one thing we have other than just reducing the thrust levers and extending the flaps are spoilers. So
okay.
you might notice if you've ever been in the back of an airplane as a passenger and you look out of the window, you'll see these panels on the top of the wings that might extend up at about a 40 to 45 degree
angle. They come up off
angle.
The wing. I've seen those, yeah.
And what those do is those destroy some of the lift, which helps the aircraft to descend at a faster rate.
It disrupts the airflow a little?
It disrupts the
okay.
airflow over the top of the wing and reduces lift, so it can help you slow down and or descend at a more rapid rate. So usually going into Detroit, in the example you gave, if they keep us high and tell us to maintain a certain speed, if we're coming in at, let's say, 9 or 10,000 feet over the airport, and they're going to give us a short approach and they say, whatever your call sign is, maintain 3,000 feet. Well, typically we'd bring the thrust levers back to idle, extend the spoilers, maybe extend the flaps, and then we'll try to go down at as quick of a rate as possible, which for us may be 2,000 to 2,500 feet per minute rate of descent.
Wow. That's pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, consider that's in a jet, the actual, if you look at the descent gradient, so if you can picture in your mind a slope that you're traveling, the descent gradient may be the same as in a Cessna 152, but because you're moving a lot faster over the ground, the descent rate is a lot higher.
Gotcha.
So in a Cessna, I'm just making up numbers arbitrarily, but let's say 1,000 feet per minute might be a 5% gradient, for example.
Okay.
You're going down a slope, a 5% slope, and it takes you, you know, in a minute of travel at 90 knots in a Cessna 152, you're going to go down the slope 1,000 feet. Well, in a jet going down that same slope, because you're moving maybe two or three times as fast, you're going to cover two or three times as many feet in that minute.
Wow.
So if they're going down the same hill in a Cessna after 1 minute, you've descended 1,000 feet, hence 1,000 feet per minute. A jet moving at 180 knots, moving two or three times as fast, going down that same slope, will have descended maybe 2,000 or 2,500 feet per minute.
Yeah, much quicker.
In that same amount of time, yeah.
Wow. So you use spoilers to slow down, and then you're going to kick in the flaps and the slats in that descent, so that really slows you down. Because, you know, the passengers are going to feel that forward pull off that seat when they, you know, just like you do on a car. You extend the flaps, and then when the gear goes down, even slows down even more, you hear the thump, and then you feel pushed again. Kind of you're getting pushed forward again.
All
it's
the
fascinating.
Drag, yeah, it's like a big air brake almost.
Yep. And that's all because you have to get that airplane slowed down quickly from being up so high to get over top of those departures on downwind.
Exactly.
Absolutely fascinating. And you guys managed to put it in.
Yeah.
Just grease it in there.
Yeah.
It's very nice. Is there an Autoland system on those particular airplanes?
Typically, Autoland is reserved for the larger heavy jets. The reason it is Autoland is a very expensive system. It's expensive to install. It's expensive to maintain. And so it's really only practical for larger aircraft that fly longer haul flights. So, for example, a 777, a Boeing 777 that's flying, you know, transatlantic, for example, and you've got this flight full of people, and maybe you're going to an airport that's fogged in, and it's expensive for you to get there, and maybe have to have bad weather where it's below the landing minimums, where you can't see enough to land safely just using manual control by the pilot. Well, it's expensive to have to divert to another airport and potentially find hotels for all the passengers and alternate transportation. In that case, it's more cost effective to install the Autoland where the pilots, it's called a monitored approach. The pilots configure the airplane and they monitor the autopilot to make sure there are no failures or discrepancies. And the autopilot can actually land itself completely as far as executing the approach, the round out, the flare, the touchdown.
It does it all.
It does it all, yeah. The pilot.
So the pilot just monitors.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so very expensive, but it's cost effective when you get to the larger airplanes that are flying longer distances and things like that. Before a regional jet like I fly, it's just not cost effective enough. So
okay, so you guys are doing hand landings.
Yes. Yeah, all of our landings are hand flown. Instrument approaches are ILS approaches at least are divided into three categories: Cat 1, 2, and 3. Cat 1 approaches typically will have minimums around 200 feet above the touchdown zone. So up from the runway, we have to see the runway environment at a minimum of 200 feet above the ground. Otherwise, we can't land for a Cat 1 approach. Cat 2 approaches, which we can also do. You typically have to see the runway environment by about 100 feet off the ground. So you get lower minimums, you can go a little bit lower before you have to execute a missed approach. Cat 3 approaches, without getting into too much detail, there are different categories of it, but the lowest minimums, Cat 3C minimums, as it's called, is literally 0-0. So, I mean, you can be completely fogged in where you can't see anything. The pilots are monitoring the instrumentation, and all you see and feel is You feel the airplane flare, you see the thrust levers come back, and then you just feel the clunk when the wheels touch. And then the autopilot will steer the airplane on the runway, do all the braking for you. And,
Yeah.
And now that's actually not authorized for any airplane right now, even the biggest ones. And the reason being, because in true 0-0 conditions, the autopilot can land it, but then you're stuck on the runway. Because how are you going to get from the runway to the gate if you literally
can't see, right.
So Cat 3B minimums, which are a little bit higher than that, where you can see, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, 20 or 50 feet ahead of you.
Yeah.
That's the lowest that's currently authorized. And then in that case, they can maybe send a truck out to the runway, one of those follow me trucks with the flashing signs.
Oh, yeah.
And that can guide you in.
Oh, neat.
So, yeah.
That's fascinating.
So there's a lot that goes into it. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. There is. I mean, but it's all this technology and knowledge and everything. And geez, think about the Wright brothers. They couldn't do that stuff back in the
day. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So we'll move on here to maintenance delays and de-icing. We're going to talk a little about that. We kind of touched on it a little bit. So talk about some, like, you know, it's not just weather that can cause a delay. It could be maintenance. Well, you could categorize weather in the de-icing, but take us to de-icing, because you had mentioned that it can cause delays as well. Let's say it's a day where you have a pretty good winter storm and you're going to depart, Mm-hmm. You want to keep the ice off the wings because it affects the airflow over the wings. Take us to a snowy day on a departure on a CRJ-900.
Sure. Well, first, let's talk about why it's important to de-ice.
Sure.
De-icing is important because you can't, at least you shouldn't, attempt to take off in an airplane with any type of ice or solid contaminants on the wings, because it disrupts the airflow.
Right.
And it affects the performance characteristics of the plane.
And adds weight.
It does add, the weight is not as critical as the change in airflow. It's mostly the lift that's affected. The weight is, it's not good, but the main problem though is that it affects the airflow
lift.
And the lift characteristics of the airplane's wing. So that's the big critical thing. But it's important to remove all that so the airplane can fly safely and perform as expected. Otherwise, you're a test pilot. You're flying an airplane in a condition that you don't know how it's going to perform.
Yeah.
You know? And safety is our first priority. So we've got to get the ice or the frost or whatever it is off the airframe. And that can cause delays because typically we try to pad the schedules in airline travel. And it's always a science because the airlines obviously are businesses. They want to maximize their profits. So they don't want to spread the flights out too far apart.
Right.
Because then they're not making as much money. But at the same time, they don't want to make them too close together. Because if they make them really close together, any little thing that happens will have a chain reaction and affect things down the line. So if they're scheduling flights at the very minimum, you know, one flight to the next flight to the next flight at the very minimum that they think they'll need. And then you have an unexpected snowstorm come in or something that happens that delays one airplane. Well, that's going to have a chain reaction. So typically they try to give the flights a little bit of padding just to make sure that you have enough time to account for small minor delays. It's not a perfect system. Sometimes you still get delays that are out of your control, but that's typically what they try to do. Now with de-icing, we'll go to a designated spot on the airport. We'll configure the airplane in order to be de-iced. Typically in order
to... Do they still call those de-ice pads?
Yeah.
Okay.
Usually, yep. So we'll go to the de-ice pad. We'll talk with we call them Iceman, the people who are driving the de-icing trucks, and we'll configure the airplane. And typically that consists of making sure the parking brake is set so we're not sliding around on the pavement. We turn off the air conditioning because you don't want to be sucking, you know, the fumes from the de-icing fluid into the airplane.
Right.
Causing, you know, throat irritation and things like that. So we close all the air conditioning up. Turn off our windshield wipers and all that stuff. And then we just sit there and let them de-ice us.
Okay.
And typically, depending on the day, there's a difference between de-icing and anti-icing fluid. There are actually four types of de-icing and anti-icing fluid. One is de-ice fluid, which usually it's like orange in color.
Okay.
So you'll see the trucks come around and they'll spray like this orange fluid over the airplane. And that is the actual de-icing fluid. It's typically hot water and... whatever glycol or fluid agents that they use in order to actually de-ice the airplane. So that gets all the ice off. And then the second type, which is in most installations, is actually type 4 anti-icing fluid, is a greenish color.
Okay.
And that's actual anti-icing fluid. So after they de-ice the airplane first, then we reconfigure if we need to, and they spray on the anti-icing fluid, which is usually green. And what that does is the anti-icing fluid is... It's usually like a mix of water, glycol, anti-corrosion inhibitors, and like dye to actually make it the green color so it's easy to identify. And what that does is it gives you what's called a holdover time. And the holdover time tells you how long that fluid is effective, because the purpose of the anti-icing fluid is to prevent ice formation. So let's say first we get the airplane de-iced with the orange fluid, and then we get an anti-ice with the greenish fluid. Well, if it's still snowing outside or whatever the case may be, if there's still frost developing or maybe freezing drizzle falling, if you don't have anti-icing capability, you'll leave the de-ice pad, and maybe by the time you're ready to take off, you're iced up again. So it defeats the purpose.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So not only do you want to de-ice, but you also want to give the airplane a certain amount of anti-icing capability, and the anti-ice fluid absorbs any liquid precipitation or solid precipitation that's falling.
So it melted on contact.
Yeah, melted on contact. Okay. It absorbs it and keeps it from adhering to the airplane.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
The things that they've you know, invented now.
Mm-hmm.
It really helps things from delays and all that.
Yeah.
Instead of having to taxi all the way back and getting back in line again.
Exactly.
Like in the old days.
Yeah. And it's not a perfect system either, because again, depending on the delay, that fluid only has a certain effective time, and it varies based on the type of fluid that they use, the concentration level, because they may spray 100% anti-icing fluid, or it could be 75% or 50% diluted with water, for example. So it depends on the temperature, the concentration, the type of fluid, and a lot of other factors. So it's rare, but it does happen where we hit the maximum useful life of the fluid, and it becomes ineffective at that point.
That?
Yeah, we have what's called holdover charts.
Okay.
And so the holdover charts allow us to factor in all those different variables and determine what's called the holdover time.
Okay.
So from the time we get de-iced to the maximum effective time of that fluid is when we want to try to take off. If we take off after that holdover time expires, if it's 30 minutes or an hour, whatever the case may be, we may have to potentially go back and get de-iced again. Yeah,
okay.
And restart that holdover time.
Wow. Imagine that at LaGuardia.
Yeah, it can be a challenge. Yeah, anywhere, but especially at LaGuardia.
And in maintenance delays, I know there's probably not too many of those, but they do happen.
They
you
do
can
happen.
Take us into that.
Airplanes are just like any other machine. Things break. Everything has a life limited. Everything in the world is life limited, rather. So with airplanes, obviously, maintenance is critical. And we keep detailed maintenance logs and records. So all the jet aircraft that you're flying are undergoing routine maintenance. And everything down to the most insignificant component is documented and recorded and a log kept on it. So we have what we call the minimum equipment list. And most of your larger jets are going to be operating using this. And so let's say something in the aircraft breaks, like let's say a passenger armrest breaks or an overhead bin breaks or a circuit breaker pops in the flight deck. Well, the first thing we do after calling our maintenance, we can call them through ACARS, like I mentioned before, or we can call them over the radio, over the phone, by virtue of the dispatcher. We tell them, hey, this broke, and then we coordinate with them. At the same time, we look at that minimum equipment list, called an MEL for short. And the minimum equipment list, I like to think of it as the maximum broken list. It's a big, thick book, and it tells you everything that can be broken on the airplane with the airplane still being considered safe for flight.
Ah.
So it's obviously, not going to include critical things. Like if the wing is falling off, that's not going to be on the MEL.
No.
Because if the wing is falling off, you're not going. You
right.
know? But the passenger armrest, if the flight attendant tells us, hey, you know, some passenger was lugging their bag and they broke the armrest. Okay, well, I get on the radio, I tell maintenance so they can come out and look at it. But at the same time, I'm going through the MEL and the MEL says, well, the passenger armrest may be inoperative provided you tape it up or whatever maintenance has to do to placard it to make sure people know that it's not safe to use.
Okay.
And then we also make a record in the maintenance log. Hey, passenger armrest in seat 5A is broken. And then once it's fixed, then maintenance comes out and makes a second recording saying passenger armrest fixed on this
day. They sign it off.
They sign it off, yeah.
Fascinating.
So, yeah, and so and all the aircraft have what's called an airworthiness release. So when the aircraft comes from the factory, it's been certified safe to fly, and we have to maintain it in a safe to fly condition. Anytime something breaks, regardless of how minor it may be, that aircraft is not considered airworthy or worthy to fly unless it's been inspected. So typically when something breaks, again, we're always going to notify maintenance, no matter how minor it is. And maintenance might do one of three things. They might, if depending on what it is, and how extensive the process is, they might fix it on the spot and then sign it off and say it's been fixed. We might ferry the airplane. So we might say, hey, we can't fix this on the spot. It's not safe to have passengers flying. So we're going to actually ferry the airplane. But it is safe to fly, but it's not with passengers.
Now,
so
explain what ferrying is.
Ferrying is the term for when an aircraft is, it's not necessarily unsafe to fly, but you don't want to fly it with passengers aboard. So let's say something breaks in LaGuardia, and we can't fix it on the spot, but we've got a maintenance base in, I don't know, Charlotte, North Carolina, for example. Well, we may ferry that airplane to Charlotte to get fixed. So in a ferry, you're only going to have the minimum crew, so you'll just have usually the two pilots, maybe a mechanic, fly the airplane empty down to Charlotte to get fixed, and then once it's fixed, it'll get a new sign-off, a new airworthiness release, and now you can fly passengers again. So depending on the problem, if we can fix it on the spot, we'll try to fix it on the spot. Or we may have to ferry the airplane empty with no passengers to get it fixed. Or you may defer it. And deferring it is a process where you say, hey, it's not critical. We can't fix it. It's not a big enough deal to have to ferry the airplane. We can still operate it safely. We're just going to put this maintenance on hold.
Okay.
That's deferring it. So like in the case of the armrest, that's a good example where it may not be practical. Like if the passengers are already boarded up, you may not want to take however long it takes to go back there. And I don't know what maintenance has to do. Maybe take a screwdriver.
20, 30,
and fix, fix it. You want to still get the flight out on time or as close to on time as possible. So they may tape it up and put a placard on it that says do not use or something. And then they'll defer it. And
okay.
we'll make the maintenance log to say, hey, this 5A armrest has been broken, being deferred. And then the next time the airplane goes in for routine maintenance, they'll fix it then.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Imagine those ferry flights are easy, a good climb ratio, empty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the plane, yeah, it climbs out like a rocket ship when it's empty, yeah.
I just thought of that. It,
yeah.
It'd be fun, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bumpier flights, too, because you don't have all the extra ballast
the
in the back. Yeah, the weight. So
that's funny.
But they're fun.
So we'll go to, we'll cover this real super quick because we actually, we touched on this, but we're going to add something. We're going to talk weight and balance.
Okay.
You can briefly go over the adults and children. We talked about that before, but what we didn't talk about was baggage.
Okay.
So if you can just briefly go over the, you know, the weights for adults and children and then talk about some baggage, how much, you know, the limits are and whatnot.
Sure. Well, every aircraft is going to have, well, first, let's backtrack and talk about why weight and balance is important.
Sure.
So cars, you can load up a car, and I'm sure you've probably all seen cars or pickup trucks driving down the street, and maybe in the pickup truck, someone has a big refrigerator or something heavy in the back, and the back of the truck is leaning down, and the suspension is really compressed. And it's not ideal, but in a car where you have four tires on the pavement, you don't have to worry about, you don't have as much of a risk of an accident with that. Whereas in an airplane flying in the air, suspended by nothing, you not only need to be light enough to safely take off and fly, but you also have to have things loaded up properly. Because if you can imagine the airplane, if you can imagine balancing an airplane on your finger, if you have too much weight in any one place in the aircraft, the airplane could become unstable and want to tip over. Well, those same principles apply in flight. So we not only have to make sure the airplane is light enough to be able to operate safely, but also that all of the passengers and cargo and fuel is loaded in such a configuration so where the airplane is within a certain balance limit. Now, most airlines use a system where we estimate the weights of passengers and cargo, and it gives us a little wiggle room because some people are going to be lighter than that weight, some people are going to be heavier than that weight, but typically it always balances out. So for the typical adult, and in summertime, for example, my airline uses 190 pounds for each adult. So we don't put everybody on a scale when you're boarding the aircraft. We just estimate your weight as an adult at 190 pounds. And for children under 12, we estimate it at 87 pounds. So some people, again, are going to be a little heavier, some people a little lighter, but that's an average weight. For your carry-on baggage, we estimate that at 30 pounds. And your standard bags that you check that we throw in the cargo bin, we estimate them at 50 pounds. So once all the passengers and cargo are boarded and we know exactly how many people are on the flight, how many bags of which type we have on the flight, then we'll go in and we'll throw all that into our performance calculation system, typically through ACARS, and it'll spit out all of our performance data that tells us roughly how heavy we are, how much runway we need for takeoff, what our takeoff speeds are going to be, and same thing on approach, how heavy we're going to be on landing, what our landing speeds are going to be, how much runway we need to safely touch down, et cetera, et cetera.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we touched on this. We actually talked about this. It was, you know, it was told to me, I don't know, many years ago that on the CRJs, they didn't allow carry-ons. And the assumption was, it was an assumption, that the reason they didn't allow carry-ons was because of weight and balance. That would put too much weight on the airplane. But you told me otherwise. So explain that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the way things might have been way back when, but I know now we allow, you probably heard it when you board a plane, hey, you're allowed one personal item and one carry-on.
Right.
And so we assume that passengers boarding are going to have a personal item, whether it's a purse or a laptop or whatever, and a carry-on.
Yeah.
And so we already factor that into the weight and balance when okay. we input all that data. So there shouldn't be any surprises there. From my experience, it's more related to the size. The RJs are smaller aircraft, and so a lot of your bigger bags are just not going to fit in the carry-on bins.
In the upper bins.
Yeah, in the overhead bins.
Okay.
So that's why a lot of, unless it's a smaller carry-on item, like a small roller bag or a smaller backpack or duffel bag, yeah, those will typically fit. But the larger ones, if you don't just check it when you get to the airport, we'll give you a pink tag at okay. my airline, and it's called gate checking. So you drop it off at the bottom of the jet bridge when you go to board, and the bag channels will take it, put it in the cargo bin, and then after we land, they'll bring it back up to the jet bridge for you to pick up.
Oh, fascinating. So it has it had nothing to do with weight and balance.
It's not to my knowledge. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that clears it up, because mm-hmm. there was an assumption out there, or maybe even a mythical thought of it.
Yeah, because if you think about it, for weight and balance, if it's your bag and we're going to put the bag on the airplane, it's going to be on the airplane. So if it's,
right.
It's like, it doesn't matter if you put it in the overhead bin or in the cargo, you're still carrying the weight.
Right.
So, I mean, unless you're going to ship it on FedEx or something on another yeah. airplane, it's still going to be in the airplane.
Absolutely.
So I doubt it'd be a weight and balance issue. It's more of a logistical issue that we just can't fit it in the overhead bins.
It's fascinating. So we went over the baggage calculations, and I think you mentioned that the max, at sea level is 84,500 pounds, correct?
Yeah, that's our maximum certificated takeoff weight in the okay. CRJ 900.
Now, how about like higher terrain? That's maybe, let's say Denver.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Denver, 5,000 feet. Is there a Does that change the weight and balance calcs?
It does. So okay. in jets, and this relates to all jets certified under what we call Part 25 of the Federal Aviation Regulations, we have what we call certification limits, and we also have performance limits. So what that means is the certification limit for the max takeoff weight under ideal conditions in the 900 is 84,500 pounds, which means under no circumstances when we're on the runway and we advance the thrust levers for takeoff, we cannot be heavier than 84,500 pounds, but that's under ideal conditions. And that's related to the structural integrity of the airplane. If you're taking off heavier than that, the aircraft structure may not be able to support that extra weight.
Okay.
But that, again, that's under ideal conditions. Depending on the circumstances in the day, the density, altitude, the weather, the runway length, we may have to be lighter than that in order to guarantee that we have the performance to get the airplane in the air.
Okay.
So if you're at a higher altitude, like in Denver, or if you're at higher temperatures or higher humidity, or if you have shorter runways, you may have to be at a lighter weight, say 75,000 pounds, for example, or 80,000 okay. pounds, just to make sure you have the performance necessary to get off the ground. So we have okay. to always make sure we're operating by the more conservative value. So if our certification limit is 84,500, but for that given day in those given circumstances, it's 80,000 pounds, we have to be at 80,000 pounds or less.
Fascinating.
In order to be able to operate safely and legally.
Okay.
So whatever the more conservative number is, that's what we're operating by.
And it's safer.
It's safer,
it's a safer calculation.
Mm-hmm. Because in airline jets, we have to always have the performance to, you'll notice all airline jets have at least two engines, the modern ones at least.
Right.
And that's just for redundancy. If one engine fails, you still have another engine to still be able to use to fly. So we have to have the performance so that on takeoff, which is one of the more critical times of flight, and if you think about it, we're on the ground or close to the ground. The engine's working as hard as it can to get you in the air. Things are happening fast. You're close to other aircraft. Typically, that's one of the most critical phases of flight. So if one of the engines fail, engine failures are really unlikely in jets anyway, but let's just say it's not your lucky day and one of the engines fails at the worst time on the takeoff, we have to have the performance to still be able to take off and get that airplane in the air if needed and clear all obstacles in the vicinity of the airport to be able to make an emergency landing and get all those passengers back on the ground safely.
Exactly.
So, and in order to be able to do that, we have to make sure that we're light enough and we have the performance to do that under all circumstances.
Okay. Out of curiosity, if you do have an engine failure, because this just popped in my head, Columbo thing. Let's say you're taking off, and you're full fuel, and you have to turn around and come back. Now, you're going to, how are you going to land? Is that going to be too much weight to land, or do you have to come up with some calculations to, like, because you haven't flown that far? You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, potentially. Now, I mentioned that we have maximum structural weight. So in the 900, the maximum takeoff weight under all circumstances, 84,500 pounds.
Okay.
Maximum landing weight, 75,100 pounds. So you might be saying to yourself, wait a minute, that's a 8,000 or 9,000 pound difference. What are you going to do if you're taking off, let's say, your maximum weight and you have to immediately turn around and land where you're going to be above that 75,100 pound limit? Well, in an emergency situation, because the RJs, we can't dump fuel like some of the bigger planes can.
Okay.
You might just have to land overweight. Now, in that case, the airplane can land overweight, but it's going to have to be inspected and probably have some maintenance, definitely have some maintenance done on it before it's authorized to fly again.
I gotcha. Okay.
But they're built so that, again, not under normal circumstances, but under emergency circumstances, such as you mentioned, it can still land safely and get passengers back on the ground. It's not going to be immediately usable, though.
Gotcha. Okay. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to ATC communications.
Okay.
Which is fun.
Great.
But the first thing I want to cover is the rules and regs, you know, for altitudes. I'm going to talk about air speeds below 10,000 feet.
Okay.
I think that's the max is 250 knots, correct?
Correct.
Explain to us why that is.
Well, aircraft can operate under one of two different sets of rules. One is called VFR or visual flight rules. The other is called IFR or instrument flight rules. Now, with VFR, it's a little more like the Wild West, for lack of a better word. You fly VFR just like you drive in a car. In a car, you maintain your distance from other cars and obstacles just by looking out of your front window and manipulating the steering wheel and the gas and brake. Well, aircraft operating under VFR do the exact same thing. They look out of the window and they keep themselves away from mountains and trees and towers and other aircraft just by using their eyeballs and manipulating the flight controls. The problem with airplanes is we don't have lanes in the sky. We don't have traffic lights. Airplanes typically move a lot faster than cars, so you want more space between aircraft than you would between a car. You know, a car on the highway might be, you know, 30 or 50 feet ahead of you. Well, that's way too close for an airplane. And because airplanes are moving a lot faster and they're not in any given lane, we want to restrict ourselves in the busier airspace to slower speeds so we have more reaction time.
Okay.
So typically, the busiest airspace is typically going to be at lower altitudes where you have large and small airplanes alike flying, closer to airports, closer to navigation fixes, things like that, that we all use. So in that busier airspace, typically 10,000 feet and below, you want to restrict yourself to 250 knots or less.
Once spacing.
That's for spacing and reaction time. Now, for aircraft flying IFR, you may be flying in the clouds where you can't see. And that's the case where you're flying with a specific air traffic control clearance for a specific lateral route and a specific altitude and oftentimes even specific speeds. So you as a pilot are not only monitoring your point in space and other aircraft around you, but air traffic control also has an eye on you, a second set of eyes, and they're monitoring you as well. That's what the airlines always use. And so all the aircraft flying, all the commercial airlines in general are always going to be IFR, just about. So we've always got that extra level of protection. But if you think of an aircraft and cruise at 30,000 feet, everybody's under air traffic control. So it's like air traffic control, if you think of it like they're moving all the chess pieces to keep us safely spaced out. So it's not as important for us to fly slower. We can speed up and fly at our best practical speed or most efficient speed because not only are we looking out, but air traffic control is looking out as well. And you don't have anyone outside of air traffic control.
Okay.
Of air traffic control's control, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's absolutely fascinating. And another thing I want to talk about is cruise altitudes.
Okay.
There's VFR, hemispherical rules, but you guys have specific hemispherical rules for cruise altitudes, if you want to mm-hmm. explain that. Because I've heard actually ATC give what is called wrong-way altitudes.
It can be done, yeah. So like you mentioned the hemispherical rules. So again, we don't have lanes in the sky. So what we do instead is we divide the atmosphere into hemispheres. So aircraft generally flying in easterly directions under visual flight rules will be flying at odd 1,000 feet altitudes plus 500. So if you're above 3,000 feet above the ground, typically you'll be flying at an odd 1,000 foot altitude, like let's say 7,500 feet or 9,500. You can do the math, 11,500. And aircraft flying in westerly directions generally, VFR will have even 1,000 plus 500 foot altitude. So 6,500, 8,500, 10,500. Aircraft flying IFR are similar. Easterly aircraft will be flying at odd 1,000 foot altitudes. So 5,000, 7,000, 11,000, for example. Whereas okay. westerly aircraft will be flying even 1,000 altitudes, 8, 10, 12,000.
So again, that's for spacing.
That's for spacing to keep us all separated. Now, air traffic control and pilots also. I mean, if you got to, you have to think we may have weather to deviate around. You may have the jet stream where one altitude it's really rough and turbulent, but you climb or descend 1,000 feet where the jet stream isn't as strong and the ride smooths out. After safety, we like comfort for our passengers. So sometimes it can be for air traffic control's needs if they have a situation where they need to change the spacing. Or it could be at the pilot's request, we may request to fly a wrong way altitude, like you mentioned. So if we're going westbound and maybe we're cruising at 36,000 feet and air traffic control, for whatever reason, they want to space us out, give us a little more space from another aircraft. They may ask us on a westbound direction to maintain an odd 1,000 foot altitude, or we may request it as well. If we request it, depending on their spacing, it may or may not be approved, but
right.
we can still request it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, but the hemispherical rules are a way to maximize spacing and efficiency. It's just another method
of safety.
Of safety, exactly.
One other thing we're going to talk about, because we're getting close to 3 minutes left here. The passengers are sitting, they're, bouncing around a little bit. They look up and they see the seatbelt sign on.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sure a few of them wonder, how does the pilot up front know when to turn that seatbelt sign on? How does he or she know when the turbulence is going to come? I mean, are they wearing infrared glasses and can see the turbulence in front? No, there's no such thing. Explain that to us.
Well, there are a couple methods that we use. We rely heavily on weather forecasts. The meteorologists have a lot of tools at their disposal to be able to tell when and where it's going to be turbulent. Another thing we use is pilot reports or PIREPS, like our podcast is called.
Absolutely.
So if you have, again, on that hypothetical flight from San Francisco to New York, if we're flying it now and maybe we have another aircraft 100 miles ahead of us who's on that same route, well, if they experience turbulence, the nice thing to do is to pass it along. So they'll tell air traffic control, hey, we're at 36,000 feet and we're getting continuous light chop turbulence, for example. And air traffic control, as a courtesy, can pass that information along to other aircraft behind that aircraft
yes.
so that we know what to expect. So we may turn on the seatbelt sign ahead of time in anticipation of that turbulence. Also, you, as a pilot, you get kind of good at reading the weather. So without going into too much detail, you can look at certain cloud types in the atmosphere. You can look at aircraft that leave contrails. You can look to see if the contrails are smooth or ragged. That can give you an idea of if the air is turbulent. If an aircraft is leaving contrails and the contrails are like a nice straight line, well, then the aircraft's in smooth air. But if the contrails are really ragged and broken up right behind the aircraft, that's an indication that it's flying through choppy
air.
Some shear potentially, yeah. So there are lots of visual cues that you can use as well. But in a nutshell, weather forecast, PIREPS, and just visual indications in the atmosphere that we use to read it. And also, you know, there are certain times when you know it's going to be turbulent. If you're flying in heavy rain or radar returns or in the vicinity of thunderstorms, for example, if you're flying through the jet stream or through a front, like those are times where you know it's going to be turbulent. So you have the seatbelt sign on in anticipation.
Cumulus clouds.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you fly through those, you know you're going to get roughed up.
Exactly.
Because of there's an updraft in them.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Well, we're going to wrap this up, but before we do, we want to mention that we are now on Facebook, PIRAPS podcast. If you want to throw us any questions for First Officer Brian Johnson or myself, look us up on Facebook. Just look up PIRAPS. Would it be in the groups section? Am I correct?
It would, yep.
Okay. Yep. And throw us out some questions on Facebook, folks. And for this particular episode of PIRAPS, this is Private Pilot Phil. And for First Officer Brian Johnson, we hope that you enjoyed this particular podcast. And have a great night, folks.
We'll see you next time.